You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Jake Kasson, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Glad to be here.
So you're the founder and CEO of Movement. Movement is a direct-to-consumer brand. I think most people would know you for your men's watches, but you've expanded to women's watches, sunglasses. I think you have some really iconic, beautiful designs, more minimalistic styles. You started in 2013 with a crowdfunding campaign and bootstrapped your way to over $70 million in revenue last year. And earlier this year, went through a $100 million acquisition by a company called Movado. They were founded 137 years ago in 1881 in Switzerland, a pretty famous watch brand. What else could be said about Movement today? How do you describe it when you're at a dinner party or something?
So we're a lifestyle accessories brand. You know, Movement itself, I believe all the great brands and you know, Movement kind of included in what we aspire to be, represent and stand for something more than just the physical product they sell. So we always use the saying, live life on your own terms. And that's something that really breathes throughout the DNA of you know, our products and our brand and the culture here at the office. So even though today we sell, you know, watches for men and women, sunglasses, jewelry, you know, the goal is no matter what kind of product or category we explore into, which, you know, as of the near future is really all in the accessories space. But again, it has meaning behind, you know, what the brand and ethos really represents, where I just feel like that was something missing in a large part of consumer kind of, you know, products or goods in the fashion space.
How would you describe that lifestyle? What does that look like? What is the Movement lifestyle?
So I think the great thing about, you know, living life on your own terms is that it represents something different to, you know, me or you or the next person. So the pillars for us are, you know, fashion's obviously important and expressing yourself through fashion and living in an aspirational lifestyle and going against the grain. I think people who are just passionate as well, you know, could be in the workplace, it could be hobbies or whatever it may be. But I think our story of kind of how we were passionate about building a business and started, you know, as broke college kids, like the influencers we work with, as an example, like a lot of these people, you know, 3 or 4 years ago were living lives that they weren't, you know, loving or going down a school path or a work path that wasn't something that they felt fulfilled doing. And they decided to change and go about it their own way. And, you know, some of these people have millions of followers now are making, you know, they're very comfortable in the way that they live and their lifestyle, and they dictate how they work and when they work. And I think we've just given, you know, thousands of creators an opportunity to have somewhat of a career, make some money, you know, working with us across the globe. So we've worked with, you know, well over 1,000 people from conception to where we are today.
Yeah, it's fascinating that I think I was probably first exposed to your brand through Instagram and the idea of influencers and people who are doing this as a full-time job is relatively new. I think Movement may have been one of the companies that enabled that lifestyle to begin in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. When we started, the word influencer wasn't even really a thing. Basically, what happened is, like, we started seeing these people who created just absolutely incredible content and really content that were imagery or video that you haven't ever seen before. You know, places you've never been, things you've never seen. We wanted this aspirational lifestyle. And we saw these people and just started reaching out to them and asking if they'd be interested in working with us, and kind of told them, you know, the story behind Movement and really trying to create relationships. You know, I think that's another difference between us and a lot of brands who are just paying people and then, you know, pay for a campaign and then on to the next. For us, it was very much like creating real relationships, and we have people in the office all the time and, you know, are doing trips with some of these creators. So we've done collabs with a couple of them. So just little things like that. But yeah, I don't really recall who else was doing it kind of before we really got into it.
I want to explore some of the beginnings of Movement. But before that, we're recording this on Tuesday, November 27. It's the day after Cyber Monday. You've had 4 or 5 days of craziness. Can you give us a bit of a report on what the last few days were like for you?
It's always crazy here. You know, it's funny enough that the majority of the craziness actually is before this holiday and this week specifically, you know, Black Friday and Cyber Monday, just because, you know, you're getting all your assets, you're talking to every influencer, you're scheduling, you know, what channels and how much you're spending, you know, on a day-to-day basis and on TV or Facebook. I mean, don't get me wrong, we have, you know, I think the people running Facebook here that we have internal or email or a handful of others are kind of scrambling a little bit more. But for the most part, most of the team, it's like, you know, we're checking in on a daily basis, seeing, you know, how we're doing. And, you know, last year was a $71 million year. And during this week, we had, you know, a handful of multi-million dollar days. You know, now we're selling jewelry and we have gift boxes. So holiday times are definitely, you know, a peak for us. And it's I don't know, it's exciting, it's fun, it's hectic. You know, we're on Shopify, so we don't have like a team of developers here, or, you know, waiting on standby, making sure the servers don't crash. Like, a lot of the bulk and the heavy lifting of the technical stuff has been, you know, removed from the holiday time. And at this point, like, we have a pretty good, we go on like a code freeze, so we don't really do anything on the website so that nothing breaks. And we've had a few years of this now, so we're much more of a well-oiled machine now than maybe in the past, where it was me and, you know, 6 p.m. You know, I used to be on live chat just because we needed, the customer service is what gets hit the hardest. And again, even that, we hire up, like, we're well equipped to do that. So knock on wood, but this year has actually been pretty smooth in comparison to previous years. I think last year we had, it was like our SSL certificate, or so it's just one thing you forget to renew or something like that. And sure enough, our website goes down on like one of these days, and we got it up within an hour. But being on Shopify has been, you know, revolutionary to us, where I've seen our competitors literally go out for this entire week. One of our competitors' websites went out for an entire week. They started sending traffic to a third-party retailer because they just couldn't figure it. I mean, that's a huge blow. I can't even imagine how that would be bad. But again, we don't worry about that stuff because we're on Shopify, so.
Yeah, so by the time Black Friday actually rolls around, you've done all the work on the product development side, on the photography, so that part is not so surprising. But are you able to project ahead of time roughly how well you'll be able to do, or is that part still a surprise?
Yeah, so, you know, I have an amazing CMO, and, you know, he has an amazing team underneath him and really helps kind of do a forecast based off of like what we, you know, year over year, what we spent last year, what we think we'll spend this year, depending on what new channels we have. So, and then also just like demand at like what percentage of growth we have every year, you know. So if you're trending towards a certain percentage, then, you know, you probably attribute that to, you know, this year as well. And then we break it off, kind of like weight it out by day in comparison to last year. So we have a fairly, I mean, we have targets that we want to hit on a daily basis. And then we can check in and see like how close we are to those targets. So it's pretty cool stuff. It's not stuff that I knew. I had to hire much smarter people to come in and you know, implement these strategies.
Well, you mentioned Shopify as a technology that you leverage that makes it a lot easier for you to scale. Are there other things along those lines that you've used that you didn't have to build in-house that really helped you?
Yeah, I mean, 99% of the things that we use are actually external applications. So, you know, Shopify itself has an app store, so we have, you know, probably like 20 plus apps. We might even have more than that, but 20 plus apps that are plugged into our website that help with different features. We have, you know, a business intelligence tool. We have, you know, an email marketing tool. We have tools for social media and posting and analytics there. You know, we have survey tools. So there's a ton of different things. Shopify as a platform is certainly like the backbone of the entire business. So that's by far, I'd say, the most important and works, you know, the most seamlessly out of the bunch of them.
Yeah. It seems like you think of the product, at least the watches, the sunglasses, et cetera, as being a core thing that you're trying to develop in-house, although I'm sure you use manufacturers as opposed to just doing it completely vertical. And then you have the influencer and the marketing side of what you're doing, which nowadays, some companies are also outsourcing that too. So are those maybe the two things that you really think are core to the business, or are there other things that you really find it's valuable for you to build in-house?
I mean, yeah, product design in-house is extremely important, I think. So just to go through, like, product design, you know, our website, which is essentially, like, you know, where we're selling the product, so making sure that the experience is good, et cetera. And then just marketing and brand kind of going hand in hand. I think those functions are important to have. I think within those functions, you can outsource certain things. So, you know, we have a 3D printer here. We have a head designer that was at a handful of, like, you know, the other kind of big watch players, spent kind of a tenure at a handful of them, and now is here, and he's been incredible. He'll kind of take our ideas and collaborate with us and, you know, pen to paper. And then, you know, we have a 3D printer here, so we'll get like a 3D printed model so we can see sizing. And before we have to send it to the manufacturer, we'll get a 3D printed, you know, model, and then we'll send it to the manufacturer. Or actually, no, sorry, we won't even send it to the manufacturer. We'll just send the digital CAD to the manufacturer because we're able to verify the size is correct rather than wasting time with, like, them printing it, shipping it to us. Like, we can expedite the process. But really having a team here who's, like, thinking about trends, understands the DNA, you know, what's going on in you know, my head and my team's head, in terms of design. And then the website's super important just from owning the data. And, you know, we outsource an agency that helps develop it. So there's components within that we use. But in terms of, like, owning and managing, like, you know, products, you know, uploading products and the data within Shopify, like, that's all us here. And then last, brand and marketing. I think maybe the most crucial, specifically brand. I mean, you have to own brand. You know, you have to really work on that. And if you're not good at brand either, you can hire someone to help with it. There's agencies, but I don't know, they're really expensive and they come in and they kind of leave. And I've always found that the best brands are kind of done in-house. And then the marketing, we've hired, you know, Facebook internally. Like, all of our media buying for the most part is done internally. We use a couple of agencies to help with certain things, you know, like the TV buying and so forth. But for the most part, it's all, you know, a big team in-house. Most of the team reports to my CMO. Like, we have a very large team of marketing folks here.
So when you launched the Indiegogo campaign back in 2013, you had a lot of this stuff figured out. You had, you know, a handful of different colorways and watch faces. You had the logo. You had the kind of some idea of what the brand was supposed to represent. How did you bring all of that stuff together when you first launched?
You know, you kind of got to figure it out when you're a one-man or two-man show at the time. You know, we had to figure out how to get watches made, what a good manufacturer was, how to get the website made, manufacturing as well, but, you know, designing and working with the manufacturer to get our design. So I'd say it was like, it wasn't done in an efficient manner, but it's, you know, that's just entrepreneurship is kind of, you know, problem solver, master problem solver. And, you know, I think that no matter what challenge kind of presents itself, you have to figure it out because no one else is going to for you. So, you know, you just have to be a problem solver.
Right around that time that you launched Movement was when Apple first launched the Apple Watch, right? That came out maybe right after?
I think it was like year two.
Did that scare you at all? Or I know that in the watch industry, it, you know, has quickly grown to becoming the biggest seller, but it seems to have not really slowed down mechanical watches. Maybe on the contrary, people are more interested in watches than ever.
You know, I don't know. It was funny when it happened, you stop and you think about it and you want to try not to be ignorant to the fact that, you know, of technology and like where it's gone and so forth. But, you know, at the end of the day, as I, you know, I'm 27 now. So like we largely built this company for a need and a want that I had. And it was easy to kind of look myself in the mirror and just be like, I still want, like, I may wear an Apple Watch, but that's more for the fitness aspect. And there's no uniqueness because of it. Like, I'm into fashion and I like I like to accessorize and express myself, and having you know, a Movement watch again that has a meaning more than just telling time, the utility of telling time. It's a fashion statement, and people have been telling time on their cell phones for over a decade. So watches have largely been the utility has been, you know, kind of unnecessary for a long time. And again, I think because of the storytelling we do with our products and the brand. Like it really hasn't made a difference for us. We have a lot of customers who have an Apple Watch and then also have a Movement Watch. It's just for a different occasion. And I think also, you know, Apple Watch has kind of been more so targeted towards the fitness and health aspect. You know, that's the utility of it more so than it is just fashion anymore.
Yeah, but I would say if I'm in the market for putting something on my wrist, and I understand like there's the, you know, evening time, daytime, workout time, different times of the day or different times that I'm whatever activity I'm into. But my choices are, for the most part, a lot of the brands that have been out there. We talked about Movado being founded 137 years ago. That's kind of the standard. I mean, the big watch brands that are out there have been around for a really long time, decades. And then you have Apple, which is obviously a huge company approaching it from a different perspective. When I think about entering the market, you know, with such huge competitors and companies that have like this heritage, one of the things that seemed to be kind of the backbone of your crowdfunding campaign was just the price point and bringing the direct-to-consumer business model to it and trying to offer something at the same quality level but half the price or something. Is that a fair assessment at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that was really our that was the way that we were going to kind of disrupt and you know, displace some of these brands by going starting with a direct-to-consumer model. We've always stood for, you know, the fact that we want to make sure that we have, you know, the highest quality, you know, products in general for the best value. So it's always been something. We're not always going to be the absolute cheapest or least expensive, but we will, you know, be competitive in price. But as we've grown, you know, there is more than just the price of the product, and we want to make sure that the brand and the community we've built and, you know, what's represented behind the brand is actually the, you know, front runner over just the price of the product. And then also, I think when we looked at a lot of these brands, though, I had no loyalty to any of these big guys or even some of the newer ones that are, you know, 20 or so years old. I had no loyalty. The brands were kind of fickle and you know, whatever the brand represented was maybe a time in my life, but it wasn't really something that evoked an emotion. And, you know, some of these were action sports or skateboarding brands. Some of them were just kind of brandless, to be honest. And that's where I really saw the opportunity. Like, price was obviously one thing, but I think it was obvious that the big guys at some point will just try and, you know, compete on price. For us, I thought that we could create a brand that did a better job at connecting with the customer emotionally. Being direct to consumer to start, again, using that channel, just gave us an advantage because that's what I knew. And unfortunately, that was the only way that we could have launched this business because we didn't have money to go and open a store. But we could reach, you know, the entire world essentially and, you know, communicate with customers instantly, and the feedback loop of product we know instantly. So like if we came out with watches, a collection, we knew the same day or even a week what was doing well versus, you know, the traditional model of selling to a retailer and they're buying 12 months out and you're guessing and blah, 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 blah. And by the time you even know what's sold, really what's sold and really have the data at your fingertips, like it's just sluggish and slow. And not to say that, again, we're going to be in retailers and we're in Nordstrom and Bloomingdale's and, you know, exploring more partnerships. I think you need to be where the consumer shops, but it's just a different way of launching a business. And being a direct-to-consumer at first allows you to move much quicker than, you know, kind of the Goliaths out there.
One of the pieces of jargon I learned, I guess, from Apple was the word complication, which is like, I guess it's a feature of a watch. It's if it has a dial that tells the date or some other kinds of different dials that do other things, those are complications. Those are things that I guess the old heritage brands have competed on. Who can fit more stuff onto a dial or who can make the most, complex movement? That was not something that you were trying to compete with. When I look back at the initial set of watches that you launched with, they were much more minimalistic and kind of looked different than what was on the market. And I think that appeals to people as well. Maybe a different demographic or a different generation is not necessarily looking for the most complex and ornate thing on their wrist.
Yeah, I mean, again, it was an aesthetic that we liked. We really wanted something that was could be worn as like an everyday watch, but had this minimalist, sleek, really beautiful design. And it was just something that we were inspired by. Like, you know, again, it's our personal taste and it's the watches that we like. And it just happened to resonate with our, you know, our customers. And our best selling watch is very minimalist and different. And you don't really see much out there like it. And it just kind of validated our concept of like what we wanted. And we didn't want to go too, you know, almost futuristic minimal, but we wanted to keep it modern, minimal, clean. And, you know, I definitely like, I have an appreciation for a lot of the luxury guys who, you know, the intricacies and, you know, the way that their watches are built are surely, you know, amazing. But for us, this was, you know, right now we use a quartz movement for our battery, you know, operated watches, which is a really reliable, you know, Miyota movement, again, at a good price. And then we actually just launched an automatic movement because for us, similarly, like what we started with, we have customers who didn't really wear, you know, watches because they didn't have loyalty or they couldn't find a watch they liked or a price point. And now as they've grown older and they've grown an appreciation for watches, they actually want like a next generation and, you know, some more moving pieces and a little more intricacy to the watch. So we actually came out with an automatic movement watch just a few months ago.
Where did your personal sense of taste around all of this come from?
I mean, there's a handful of brands that like I think we either pulled, you know, inspiration from or loved the aesthetic of. And just in general, like whether it's, you know, architecture or it's, you know, furniture, like I really love contemporary design. I'm not an artist by any means, but I think I have a good eye for fashion and like at least, you know, very much so contemporary design and fashion. And, you know, we have a handful of people who kind of work on it together. And again, our designer comes in and really helps, you know, expedite the process and put pen to paper. And he's been at all these watch brands. So he's helped just even educate us to a further degree. And there's definitely like, you know, pieces of inspiration from the watch industry. And it just depends on also what style of watch, whether it's a sports watch, the sporty watch, or it's a, you know, it's a more, you know, formal looking watch. So
do you remember what exposed you to the style of design, whether it's in furniture or architecture or something else? Was there something, was there a person or something that got you interested in all of that?
No, I think you know, it's funny. I used to like go and I'm a big believer in law of attraction. So I used to go and open up Tumblr and just go and find, it was actually funny. There was a Tumblr that we worked with as like kind of an affiliate. It was some 18 or 19 year old kid in like Sweden or something. And it was, he actually would post like these vision boards of like just contemporary, whether it was like, whether it was cars or it was houses or furniture. And it was kind of like this really aspirational lifestyle that I actually wanted. It was like, I wanted to live that lifestyle, but I think I started to see these like high res images of it could just, whatever it was, you know, it could be a house or a table or a bed. And I think I just fell in love with like these images, and I started following a bunch of Tumblrs, and every night before I went to bed, I would look at it. So it had an aspirational piece to it. It had like, you know, again, the contemporary design to it, and it just fit like a lot. It like helped me kind of form this, you know, outlook, I guess you can say.
I found that maybe the generation below me, I'm 32, seems to be much more in tune or aware of design and that people do this. Because I went to school for industrial design and you know, pursued that as a career, but I didn't realize that was a job until I was halfway through my first degree in biology. But nowadays, I feel like younger kids understand that more intuitively, that people are designing all of these objects that are around us. Is that something that you knew instinctively that was something that you could do?
No, not really. I mean, design wasn't my strong suit. So I was always thinking about, you know, what business I can start. And I've been good at like a variety of things, but I've never been great at just one.
Yeah.
You know, like I taught myself video editing, Photoshop, you know, kind of creating websites and a handful of other like kind of what I thought to be useless talents, which actually, you know, combined helped me start a business. So I was never like specifically, I guess, aware of like what opportunities there were for, you know, to your point that people were designing all these things.
But going back to pre-movement, you started, was your first business a t-shirt company?
Yeah, I started a t-shirt company before.
It's so funny because my co-founder Jesse and I both have a very similar path to you, because we started a company around fabric printing on t-shirts and then went on to do a Kickstarter campaign kind of around the same time, like 2012. So there's some interesting similarities, and I'm curious how you got involved in selling t-shirts.
How I got started selling t-shirts. What was your t-shirt company, if you don't mind me asking, just out of curiosity?
Well, actually, I didn't start a t-shirt company, but my co-founder, Jesse, did. When she was in high school, she started screen printing t-shirts in her basement, and she was living in Detroit at the time, but she moved out to LA and started selling them, going door to door and on Melrose, trying to get small boutiques to carry her stuff. And then she did that. And one of the things that she found to be really challenging about the t-shirt industry is just that it's like a commodity. Everything has been done on a t-shirt. So she was trying to figure out how to make them more unique and started developing a new printing process. And that's when Jesse and I met. We were studying industrial design in school. And we developed a new printing technology for printing on fabric, which uses sunlight, kind of like a photography process, but for fabric.
So it actually wasn't like screen printing at first. It got kind of to that at some point, but I found these t-shirts on eBay, or I found this t-shirt on YouTube actually. It was a sound activated light up t-shirt. Basically, there's this like thin electro luminescent panel on a t-shirt that was sewed on with a little battery pack in the side of the t-shirt. So it was certainly bulky, but in a dark room or like out at night, it would light up to the sound of music or, you know, the sound of clapping or whatever it was. So definitely like would, you know, get attention and people would, you know, be drawn to it. And I went down. So basically I saw it, went on eBay, bought one, thought it was really interesting. Asked my dad if I could go and basically if I can get a loan and buy some of these. And so I went on Alibaba, bought 200 of them, and he basically used my car for collateral. So if I didn't sell through the t-shirts, he was just going to sell my car. So I was like, yeah. Do or die.
That's pretty aggressive.
Yeah. I mean, I think he knew the concept. He's like, I want this to feel real. So I don't know that he would have, but those are like good lessons, you know, like if, you know, it's not that my parents were well off. We were okay. We were comfortable enough. Although during this time, my dad's company actually went out of business. So I kind of saw things turn for the worse. So, but I think just, you know, it was a good lesson. Rather than feeling comfortable and you can just, you know, try and fail, like when your back's against the wall, that's when it's a do or die mentality, right? Like you figure it out, you have to. So I went to Third Street Promenade. I didn't even have my license. I'd pay my friend to drive me an hour. We'd go to Third Street Promenade on a weekend, and with a backpack on and t-shirts, wearing t-shirts, you know, we just sell through these t-shirts. We'd have people, crowds of people surrounding us. It was crazy because, you know, there's these dancers and musicians on Third Street Promenade entertaining that were like had permits to entertain. And we would get more people around us to the point where like the dancers actually placed an order because they wanted to attract more attention to their, like, you know.
Well, there's a symbiotic relationship between your t-shirts and the music that they're playing.
Exactly. So they loved it, and they would be dancing, and like the battery packs would be falling out. It was pretty, but it was just like a cool experience to see. And anyways, fast forward, I sold through, you know, all the t-shirts, and the one thing I kept getting asked was, you know, what's your website? Where can I buy these online? And I didn't have a website, so I, you know, again, do or die. I basically took all the money, reinvested in t-shirts, and started a website, and, you know, sold like a one or two t-shirts a week. It wasn't anything crazy, and learned how to, like, you know, hired someone to build a website. And then from there, I started creating these YouTube videos of, basically, I, you know, Kanye West just came out with a new album, Love Lockdown, and he did an MTV Music Award performance, and it was live, and I connected my video camera up to the TV and recorded like the first, you know, 10 seconds of it, and I'd go to YouTube, and this was YouTube in 2007, so they didn't have any like copyright or anything like that, so I basically plug him into, I'd have the first 5 seconds of Kanye, and it'd say Kanye West, you know, Love Lockdown music video. And then 5 seconds in, it would cut to me with this light up t-shirt. I think there's one or two still on YouTube that have like 500,000 views. And And then it would be me with my t-shirt and light up, and I'd go, hey, check it out, blah, 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 blah. And then sure enough, I get, you know, 500,000 and a million. Wow. There's a handful of videos that reached a million views. And I just started selling thousands of dollars of these t-shirts a day. And that's where, like, it just kind of transitioned to another business that kind of took place and so forth. So that was like my first experience, and it kind of never stopped from there.
And the t-shirt business exposed you to the basic concept of sourcing and finding manufacturers or this product that was out there. I'm sure that helped when you started to decide to make watches. Like, how am I going to find someone to help me actually make this?
Yeah, you know, it was really funny because I basically dropped out of college in 19 to open up a store for the t-shirt business turned into like a whole bunch of different products. And I sold stuff for like Coachella and EDC and all these things. And I opened up a mall I opened up a store in the Northridge Mall and took my eye away from the website a bit to run the store. And so, you know, I had this store, I had overhead, I had to be at the store. So I had to drop out of college and I had employees and the store was doing well. I did like $50,000 in December, which was great for me. And I was, you know, super excited about that. And then 8 months later, my store, I was losing money in the store. I had to, you know, basically, you know, my company was going bankrupt. I had to close everything down, default on the lease because I couldn't pay. So they let me out of they let me break the lease just because I couldn't even pay them anymore. And I essentially closed down this business I had for 5 years. And it's funny, I remember the night, you know, officially I threw everything away. I had to do it all myself. Like, didn't have money to even pay someone to come and help me do any of this. I'd have to, like, you know, tell friends I'd buy them $5 Subway. And at the end of it, I remember going, well, shit, if I could, I don't have anything I could write down right now in terms of like what I learned here. Like, I don't know. I just don't know what I learned. Like, fast forward to when I started Movement and I started to reach these different kind of crossroads for decisions, I looked back to my previous business and said, yeah, I'm not doing that. I already did that. Let's not do that again. Or let's do this because I already did that. And I just started to realize, like, oh, okay, you know what? I actually have learned a lot. And I kind of got down on myself in the beginning before Movement because I thought I hadn't learned any lessons. But those lessons are applied when you kind of hit a fork in the road again and have to make those decisions there. So certainly from building a website to marketing to sourcing to not opening a store and focusing on a direct model first and not spreading yourself too thin, like, and also just kind of staying close to competitors who did succeed that when I didn't in that space, I learned from them. So, and I'm actually friends with a guy who kind of put me out of business. So he always says I owe him a percentage of the acquisition just because he put me out of business.
He taught you a good lesson.
He got me out of an industry, which I couldn't compete with him. He's a master entrepreneur. So he was on Shark Tank, and
wow.
I think they quoted him as the best entrepreneur they've ever met or something like that. So
what's his name?
Brian Lim, and he's at a company called Amazing Lights. But he owns like three different brands. He has – yeah, he's intense, but we're friends now, and it's funny because I can kind of help him in different ways, and he has a more complex business, so that was another thing. Is like my business was very complex with a lot of different pieces and parts, and I started selling these lights that were even more complicated than the t-shirts, and so I think I learned a lot of what not to do. I had a lot of headaches, and I was like, I don't want to have to do that again. It was very hard to manage. I spent more time focusing on sourcing than I did on the marketing, and I knew that marketing and the brand were the backbone of the business.
One of the choices that you made with Movement was to not pursue investors, especially in a time when many of the other direct-to-consumer brands were going that path. How did you make that decision? Because that was a new choice.
Yeah, so for me, I was a 21-year-old dropout with kind of a failed business. I didn't even think that it was possible to get investment. And I don't know that it would have been, to be honest. I didn't really know much about venture capital. I knew Shark Tank and I knew crowdfunding. And I saw a lot of people making money through crowdfunding, and I thought I could do it better, and I thought I had more experience. And I started to talk to people who it was their first business venture, and it just kind of happened. And not to take anything away from them, but you know, there was a Kickstarter and Indiegogo craze that was really working, and Kickstarter more so than Indiegogo. I think Kickstarter was a little easier at one point in time if you had a unique product. And we actually applied to Kickstarter twice and got denied both times just because our product wasn't, in their mind, it wasn't an innovative product. It was a fashion product. So Kickstarter denied us, and since then they've certainly changed their guidelines on what that you're able to launch. But we took to Indiegogo, but we studied every single campaign that launched on both platforms. And if something launched, we knew if it was going to be successful just because we had done so much, you know, due diligence on the platform and knew the ins and outs, and then, yeah, ended up launching on Indiegogo. But the reason we did it is because, like, you know what, we basically maxed out a credit card with no interest on the credit card for, you know, 18 months and said, okay, like, this is all we got. We have to go and we have to make money on Indiegogo, at least break even for sure, obviously. But that's not what we're shooting for. We're shooting to make, you know, a six-figure goal. And even, like, the goal, if you go to the campaign, it only says $15,000. But that wasn't actually the goal. That was just a strategy that we had used. Because, like, the concept there was, if you have a six-figure goal, someone's going to come and go, they're not going to hit that. Like, I'll come back later. Versus, you know, a much smaller, you know, five-figure goal where someone's going to just give you money because they anticipate you hitting it. And we even, like, you know, put some fake money into it in the beginning, like $1,000 or $2,000, just so that it already looked like we were, you know, 10 or 15% of the way there. And so there's all these different hacks that we did to get there. But it just goes to show that, like, all these little pieces of effort, you ended up paying off in the long run.
What did you learn from the backers themselves? You had about 2,000-ish backers. Was there feedback that came from that that informed the next versions of the product?
Yeah, we were really close to the original backers, just because we were constantly talking to them about, you know, what they liked, what they didn't like, feedback on the watch. And we just made sure that we really took care of the original backers just because, you know, we really feel, you know, I don't know, we feel connected to them. They really helped, you know, this vision become a reality. But I don't know, they informed us a bunch. We'd give surveys or we'd, you know, reach out to them. And I'd constantly be talking to a handful of them via email in the initial days. Like I probably had a handful of just full-on conversations, whether it was on phone or over email with a lot of the original backers, just because, you know, in the beginning, like, those were the only customers we really had.
So you raised $220,000 roughly on Indiegogo, but going from that to, you know, making over $70 million in a year, that's a big stretch, and a lot of companies decide at some point to take venture investment. Why did you choose not to?
So we had two campaigns that, like, basically the first one was like 30 days and we extended it and created another campaign. So all in all, we raised just under $300,000 on Indiegogo. Outside of that though, you know, we were profitable. We were making money. We are profitable. So we were kind of like, why do we need money? And I never really got a straight answer from someone on why we did. And so we never raised money. And you know, at the very, very end, before we got acquired, we actually were, you know, thinking about raising capital. And we were going to raise capital to help expand into retail and have our own stores and expand into, you know, offline and get third-party retailers to have, you know, our product in stores. So I think for us, a direct-to-consumer model, you can just stay very lean and not have a ton of overhead, and you don't need to raise money unless you're, you know, trying to go massive at scale. But for people who can't raise money, you know, I think there's a few options. You either have crowdfunding, which is great, and I always think you should do it if you have a consumer product that, like, reaches the masses. That people will buy, or you can go to, like, friends, family, angels, and just raise, you know, money through them. But ideally, like, you don't have to have a business that you're going to have to go raise, you know, a ton of money. And if you do, like, you raise initially through, you know, friends, family, whatever, and then you prove kind of proof of concept, and if it works, then you can make the decision on, you know, where the vision is from there, and if you want to actually go and start raising money through VCs, because it just, you get down a slippery slope with that, and we never did it, but I have a lot of friends who have, and they're certainly good and bad. Like, you know, some of these businesses wouldn't be around without venture backing, but for us, we were just, I don't know if it was that we were fortunate or we were just super, super disciplined. I think that's definitely a piece of it, just being super disciplined to not go and spend a dollar anywhere that we're not going to make at least a dollar, ideally two, three, or four, you know, back. So we were just very targeted with, like, how we spent money. And if we hired someone, you know, is their salary going to make us, you know, at least equivalent, if not more, in that year? And that's just kind of been our way of thinking. But I don't know, things change. Like, if you want to build a brand that you're trying to disrupt a huge industry, you know, like even Dollar Shave Club, like, they, you know, you probably have to raise if you're them and have a subscription model and really low products. And you know, you're not even maybe making money until, you know, people buy a fourth or a fifth time. You know, for us, we have a high price point watch in comparison, or you know, product in comparison to Razors or some of these other brands. So,
well, but
does that make sense?
Sure, but at the same time, I think where most people would wonder is, were you using that pre-order model to fund future iterations of the product, or were you, did you have enough cash in the bank to be able to make, you know, place some POs with the manufacturers to actually get the product? Getting that inventory in the first place is maybe where that cash comes in handy.
Yeah, so Indiegogo, when we raised $300,000, you know, a good piece of that was profit that we just reinvested back in the business for more watches, the, you know, improved website, et cetera. And then, you know, as we started selling through watches, we'd use that profit to come out with, you know, new products or, you know, whatever it was. And we would move slow, don't get me wrong. Like, you know, if we were venture-backed, we would have moved much quicker. But I don't know, it just seemed like the right thing to do. And we were working at the pace that we were comfortable with. And
so that Indiegogo was really the beginning that set up the flywheel. So every time you created another product or a new product line or a new style or a new colorway, you were just basing that off of the profits of the previous watches that you've sold.
Yeah, exactly. So we just were a profitable company, and, like, you know, Kramer and I weren't really paying ourselves much at all, and we didn't really have an office until the second year. And we lived in an apartment together, and we were just like, all right, let's just live in this apartment. It's our office. Let's not spend a lot of money, and let's just see where we can take this. And, you know, rather than, like, getting an office at the gate or a WeWork or this or that, not to say some of these are bad, but just for us, we were just very, very disciplined and spent money on, you know, more inventory, or spent money on, you know, branding stuff or things that, like, the website to improve an experience. So really just trying to, like, make it a better brand and shopping experience for the customer was kind of where we – what we were always trying to do versus, and we moved as quickly as we could with the profit we made. We do some pre-orders every once in a while, but we never did the fund us and we'll ship your product in 6 months thing. Like, there was a few times where we sold out and we would be like, hey, you know, feel free to pre-order right now. Shipping date is in a month from now, whatever. And that would help us kind of, you know, get some money up front and so forth. But I don't know. It was very, just very disciplined.
Did you ever come up with designs and that didn't sell, that you had a bunch of inventory with that you couldn't do anything, had to discount them, or what did you do? Did that ever come up?
No, fortunately not. I mean, we moved so slow. I feel like we had such a large customer base and did such a good job with the brand that, like, you know, everything that we've come out with, I feel like we've got some feedback and we've done a ton of iterations. And then when we finally come out with the finished product, people are really happy with it. You know, there's certainly some SKUs now when we have a larger, you know, assortment that don't do as well. But, you know, if we find that, we'll, you know, get rid of them at some point or phase them out. So
let's talk about the Movado acquisition. When did you start thinking about that? Was that something that you went out seeking to sell the company, or did they approach you, or were there other companies that were asking you if you would sell? How did that happen?
So yeah, we were going out to actually raise money, and again, looking to help scale the business in other areas. That we have a good system here for our direct to consumer business. Like, we know online, we know, you know, digital. What we don't know as well is the offline world. And we were getting ready to go and get money to help build, you know, hire people and, you know, get inventory, and just a lot of infrastructure that needed to be built. And as we were talking to different investors, like, we had a relationship with Movado, so just kind of called and talked to them and told them that we were raising. And it ended up that, like, after meeting them and seeing the synergies and like, they think, you know, they love brand and are so, you know, enthused by, you know, the brand that we've built and the team that we have and the product that we've built, that it just made sense kind of when we started talking about it and decided to, you know, partner up, and that they wanted to acquire us. And, you know, me and my business partner Kramer still run the show here. It's still the same team. Like, nothing really has changed. They help us with the back end and supply chain and certain infrastructure things that we were already going to have to do on our own. But outside of that, like, you know, the vision, everything stays the same, which I think is so unique. Like, even our employees at first were probably like, okay, what does this mean? What does this mean? Nothing's really changed. So it's really a great partnership, and the team over there is great. And, you know, it's still early, but really excited for the next, 2019 and years to come.
You mentioned you had a relationship with them before. How did that come about?
It was just a warm intro back in the day. We didn't really know. We were just like we had a phone call. So not really a great relationship, but just a phone call, kind of introduced ourselves, told them what we were doing. And
what was the idea back then? Was it you wanted to, you just had that in the back of your mind as a potential investor later down the road or as a partner for something? Or how did you, what was it that made you take that phone call? Because in a way they were a competitor.
We didn't really know, to be completely honest. We just, our mentors say, hey, you should always just like, have a dialogue with, kind of some of the bigger players, whether it's an acquisition or it's a partnership in some way or another that makes sense. So, we talked to other like big wash players about different, partnerships, no one really about like acquiring. But so, again, there was no agenda. It was just kind of introducing ourselves and saying hello.
With now that you're part of that family, I guess, what are the types of things? You mentioned supply chain, for instance. Are there other types of benefits that you get from being part of the company that allow you to move quicker or make a product that previously you wouldn't have been able to do? Is the automatic movement something that is part of that collaboration? Or
no, that was something that we were already doing. But just, they have access to, so many different, really, really strong manufacturers. And they're actually really impressed and happy with, the suppliers that we're working with. But, they don't change anything in terms of design or anything like that. But they help us, they're able to give us insight. I think, they have people in Hong Kong and China, so they can help us just with additional leverage there in terms of like, quality control and sourcing and so forth. And then in terms of like retail or anything offline, like that's their bread and butter. They have partnerships with so many different stores in so many different countries and have offices in Switzerland and like I said, Hong Kong and a handful of other areas. So they really know this space globally, which is an area where we wanted help in the offline world. So I think the growth, it was really growth. Like they're going to help us scale the business and do it in a tasteful way where like brand is the first priority. Brand and product are the first priority. So
I've read that you've been working with your mom for a long time. She was with you all the way back in the t-shirt days. Is she working still at Movement?
She is. So today's Tuesday and she's actually here today. So she comes in every Tuesday, drives like an hour and a half from sometimes two from there here and back from Valencia, which I don't love, but she insists on, she wants to be out here. But she does like, she helps with HR and not accounting, but like some of the kind of bookkeeping and kind of miscellaneous things from insurance to other things. So yeah, she's always kind of been, she's done a handful of different roles and that kind of all build up into, a full-time role. But she's helped me in every business, and this was the first time I was actually able to give her, equity and pay her a real salary. So I'm just glad to see that I've been able to pay her back from everything before. Because back in the day, it was like giving her free shirts, and she just liked saying that she worked for her son. I wasn't actually able to pay her like a real salary.
So is she technically a Movado employee now?
Yeah, I think that technically we all are.
That's funny. Is she someone you, what did you go to? All the responsibilities that you mentioned, but what do you go to your mom for? Is she giving you advice or a sniff test on some of the big decisions you're trying to make?
To be honest, I didn't even tell my parents until the week before the news came publicly.
Wow.
I just didn't want them to stress out, because there's just so much that could go, not wrong, but just that could change, or, I don't want to get their hopes up. And since then, I'm helping them buy places out in Colorado to retire in the next few years. So this is always like my goal. Is the first thing I wanted to do was like, set them up to live comfortably, because again, my dad's business went under, so I kind of saw them go from comfortable to like run through their life savings to, now my dad was an entrepreneur and is an entrepreneur and helped me with a lot of decisions. His business was never this size, so like this is a whole different kind of ball game. And I'd go to them and talk to them about stuff, but it's just so hard to relate unless you've been in this exact position or something similar. So I actually, you know, I talk to them about life and personal life and balance and stuff like that, but I don't really, the decisions I leave to, you know, me, my team, and then, you know, mentors that are, you know, in this space that have a lot to share.
Do you see yourself continuing over the next 5 years with movement or starting something new, or like, where do you see yourself in a few years from now?
Yeah, I'm definitely here for the foreseeable future. You know, I love more than anything to watch movement become this global offline, you know, omnichannel brand that is respected and you know, and is here for decades and decades to come. So I'm really excited for the next chapter. You know, outside of like, you know, maybe way down the road, I don't know. I think again, I want to be here for the foreseeable future. And, you know, maybe there's other things that I've wanted to do that, but it's kind of hard to even think about that right now, to be honest. Like, I feel like I have to be all in on movement, and I am all in here. So it's not stuff that I've really pondered too much about.
Amazing. If people want to find out more about movement, it's mvmt.com, and people can, or I guess mvmtwatches.com is where they can learn more and get themselves a watch.
Yep. And there we have both domains. So mvmt.com.
Oh, good.
yeah, if you want to get a hold of me, the best is I have either my Instagram. I try and respond to DMs. That's what I'm probably on the most, which is just Jake, JakeKassan, Kassan. And then my website's jakekassan.com. So
what's your favorite model? What do you wear most of the time?
Right now, I'm wearing the Rise collection. I'm wearing the Oath. The Rise is my favorite watch that we have. It just feels the best. It's a good size. I don't know. It's something that we spent a lot of time on. And, like, I remember, like, the inspiration really behind it. And it was, like, I feel like from the beginning till end, we were just really, really excited about this. So, and it has some great colors. And, I feel like this watch, just the bracelet on it, is one of the cleanest, best looking. And it's a good price point. I think it's, like, right around... It's like between 125 and 140.
I was in the market for some new sunglasses, and I saw a really great deal on the Icon sunglasses. So I actually got those over the holiday weekend. I'm very excited to see them in person.
Awesome. Well, appreciate it, man.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll put all those links in the show notes, and people can go check this stuff out.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.